Hello everyone and welcome to episode 593 of So You Want to Be a Writer, the podcast that's all about writing and publishing. My name's Valerie Koo. I'm CEO of the Australian Writers' Centre, the world's leading centre for writing courses, and I'm your host. What have you been up to this week? I recently went to an event run by an organization called Chief Executive Women, and I was actually able to catch up with some wonderful women who I went to uni with. One of them I hadn't seen in decades, and it was amazing. It was like no time had passed, you know, since we last spoke. It was really as if the last, 20 years didn't even happen. I think there's something about catching up with people who have known you since you were fairly young, because I think those people really know the essence of who you are, you know, before you've had more experiences in the world and possibly before you've been jaded or influenced or impacted or affected by whatever circumstances that, you know, you've encountered in life. They knew you when you were all young and you had such clean slates in life. And it was just so refreshing to talk to someone who knew you before, well, you know, before everything really. It was also great to see how many of them had written books, you know, and it was since it was run by the organization, Chief Executive Women, it's probably not surprising that a lot of those books were business books or rather books about their area of expertise. And some of them had done our courses at the Australian Writers' Centre, especially the course Write a Book That Showcases Your Expertise. Because on this podcast, you mainly hear about graduates who have released novels and wonderful works of fiction. But I'm also super passionate about helping people in the business community as well. With courses like Plain English Business Writing that we have at the Australian Writers' Centre and the Workplace Writing Workshop, I think that, you know, I love helping that group of people, largely because that's a big part of my background in the corporate world. And I just saw such a need there. But of course, this podcast does focus more on the wonderful world of fiction and creative nonfiction and memoir. Oh, and one thing that I wanted to remind you of is our wonderful free event that's on this week. It's open to everyone all over the world. It's on Thursday, the 14th of March, and it's at 7:30 p.m. Sydney, Melbourne time. You'll probably gain access from 7 or 7:15, and it is worth going early, logging in early, because you'll get to experience some fantastic graduates at the Australian Writers' Centre who have gone on to achieve great success. But I digress. The main event starts at 7:30 p.m. on Thursday, the 14th of March, and it's live on Zoom. Now, it is free, but you do have to register to get the Zoom link, right? Because this is going to be a fantastic event with me and Pamela Freeman, who is author of more than 40 books, and she has written across so many genres, and she has written under, you know, Pamela Freeman and Pamela Hart and Elizabeth Layden. So she's definitely a career author who can tell you more than a thing or two about how to be a successful writer, because that's what the topic is, how to be a successful writer, even if you have no idea where to start. And between myself and Pamela, yeah, we do know a thing or two about this topic. I started the Australian Writers' Centre around 18 years ago, and since then we've had over 100,000 enrolments. So we've seen people go from not knowing a lot about writing to then become best-selling authors. So we've learned a lot about what works and what doesn't, and most importantly, what it takes to make your writing career a success. So if you want to find out more, or you want to register for the free event, go to writerscentre.com.au/creative coaching. That's writerscentre.com.au/creative coaching. And now it's time to welcome Nat Newman to share her writing tip with us this week. What have you been up to before we get into your words of wisdom? What have you been up to this week, Nat?
Oh, I've been super, super busy, Valerie. I'm currently knee deep in rehearsals for two plays. I'm producing another play. We just had our premiere of our movie, and I'm studying now as well, and it's mental. It's mental in my house, in my brain.
Oh my goodness.
House.
What are you studying?
Oh, so I decided to go to TAFE to do a certificate 3 in screen and media, because, you know, I made that short film last year.
Yes.
And I was so fascinated what with what all the technical aspects of it, you know, like the people who were doing the sound and some of the choices that were being made about cinematography and stuff like that. And I thought, I want to know the practical side of this so that the next movie I make, I know what everyone's doing. And, you know, I may not be able to step in and do it for them, but at least I know what they're doing. So, yeah, I just thought that was a good good skill to have as a producer and possibly film director in the future.
And you're learning stuff?
Yes, so much stuff. Oh, my God. Mostly what I'm learning, Valerie, is that 18-year-olds have incredible amounts of patience.
What do you mean?
Well, so most of the people in my course are, you know, they're straight out of high school. Some of them aren't even 18. And we've got some classes that are not very interesting. And they can just sit there for the whole 2 hours and they don't look at their phones. They just listen attentively and they just pay attention because they're used to doing it from school. Whereas there's four of us there who are, you know, adults, grown-ups, and we're the ones constantly asking questions and fiddling with our phones and needing to get up and, you know, go to the loo or whatever. Yeah, because, you know, once you get into a working environment, you have a bit more freedom and you're sort of used to, I don't know. We just don't have the patience that these young people do. And I'm finding it really I don't know. I love seeing it and it's making me think, yeah, just sit down, shut up and pay attention for 2 hours. And you can do it. If these 18-year-olds can do it, so can I.
All right. Well, let's move on to our writing tip this week. What have you got for us?
Yeah, okay, cool. So one thing that comes up a lot in our Novel Writing Essentials course, which I'm a tutor for, is people want to know if you can be both, like, do you have to choose if you're a pantser or a plotter? So so for those people who don't know, a plotter is obviously someone who meticulously plans out what their story or their book is going to be about. And a pantser is what we call someone who writes by the seat of their pants. And I think my feeling is, and
meaning they make it up as they don't know what's going to happen. They just let it unfold.
Exactly. And my experience of talking with loads and loads of writers over the years is that most people aren't one or the other. Some people are. Some people are super plotters and they're amazing. But most people will kind of, you know, you might write a chapter and think, yeah, actually, I think there's something there. And then you might sort of plot out a few chapters or put, you know, plant a few seeds sort of thing. And then you'll go back and write a few chapters and then you might pause and plan a few more chapters and then go back and write a few more chapters. So I think it's a lot more organic than that. I know for myself, I write very organically for the first couple of chapters and then I'll reach a point where I go, I know what my next kind of beat is that I need to aim for, or I know what flag essentially I need to aim for. So rather than plotting it out meticulously, and then I'll sort of keep aiming for those little signposts, you might call them.
Yeah, sort of like some level of hybrid, depending on which end of the spectrum you are. Some people plot it out completely, as we know, but some people, they call themselves pantsers, but they know what's going to happen in the end.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're heading in a particular direction, clearly.
Yeah, yeah. I think if you know what the climax is, you're not really not entirely a pantser because you've got some idea. I think we all do that. We do that naturally. You kind of, it's even, I think about it like cooking. You know, when you, if you're cooking something complicated and you sort of stand in the kitchen and you kind of have to map out in what order you're going to do things and you're not entirely sure how the whole meal is going to come together, but you've got some idea of what order things need to go in. And I think it's a bit like that when you're writing as well. You kind of, you've got a rough idea of how things should go together and then you kind of write towards that and then hopefully you create an amazing tasty dish by the end of it.
But what's your advice then? I mean, do people need to determine early on whether they're a plotter or a pantser? I mean, do they need a name?
No, and I think that's actually a really good question, Valerie, because I do think people maybe get caught up in sort of trying to decide, oh, what type of writer am I and what sort of writer should I be? Whatever kind of writer you are is the kind of writer you are. And don't worry about what your process is or what other people are doing. Certainly be inspired by other people and maybe test out what works for other people. But in the end, you have to find your own process and your own style. And
yeah, everyone's so different.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, fantastic. Wonderful writing tip this week, Nat, or really writing insight or something to think about, isn't it?
Yes, we'll call it an insight.
All right. Thanks. And we'll talk to you again next week, Nat.
Thanks, Valerie.
Let's move on to our competition this week. All right, this week I'm giving away three copies of Has Anyone Seen Charlotte Salter? An atmospheric and tension-filled thriller by suspense master Nikki French, delving into the lives of two families shattered by tragedy and the long-buried secrets poised to surface after decades of waiting to be unveiled. You can also meet Nikki French, who of course is two different people, a husband and wife, on episode 527 of our podcast. Here's the blurb. On the day of Alex Salter's 50th birthday party, his wife Charlotte vanishes. Most of the small English village of Glenstead is at the party for hours before anyone realises she is missing. While Alec brushes off her disappearance, their four children, especially 15-year-old Etty, grow increasingly anxious as the cold winter hours become days and she doesn't return. Then Etty and her friend Morgan find the body of Morgan's father and the Salters' neighbour, Duncan Ackley, floating in the river. The police conclude that Duncan and Charlotte were having an affair before he killed her and committed suicide. 30 years later, Morgan Ackley returns to Glenstead with his older brother to make a podcast based on their shared tragedy with the Salters. Alec, stricken with dementia, is entering an elder care facility while Etty helps put his affairs in order. But when the Ackleys ask to interview the Salters, the entire town gets caught up in the unresolved cases. Allegations fly, secrets come to light, and a suspicious fire leads to a murder. With the podcast making national news, London sends Detective Inspector Maud O'Connor to Glenstead to take over the investigation. She will stop at nothing to uncover the truth as a new and terrifying picture of what really happened to Charlotte Salter and Duncan Ackley emerges. Okay, so I have three copies of this book by Nikki French to give away. It is Has Anyone Seen Charlotte Salter by Nikki French. Just go to writercentre.com.au/win. Entries close on the 18th of March. So I've made it really easy for you to enter. It's writerscentre.com.au/win and follow the instructions to enter. And don't worry, if you're at that URL in the future, there'll be some other fantastic competition there for you to enter. And now, are you ready for the word of the week? The word of the week is moiety. That's M-O-I-E-T-Y, moiety. I know, unusual, right? The plural is moieties. This is one of those words that you've maybe read and maybe understood in context, but may not have actually looked up or, you know the exact meaning. So a moiety is a half, and it comes from the Latin medietas, meaning half. It can also mean an indefinite portion, which is quite different to a half, but there you go. That's the English language for you. So, moiety, and that was the word of the week. This podcast is brought to you by the Australian Writers' Centre, a world leader in writing courses. Our hugely popular course, How to Write About Murder, is all about creating more authentic action for your crime or thriller novel. Presented by award-winning crime author Candace Fox, this course covers 9 modules of fascinating detail, taking you beyond the police tape to explore what motivates killers and how they go about their business. You'll also immerse yourself in the chase, from the murder scene and autopsy to the investigation that follows. Here's what Danuka McKenzie says.
I am now a published author. My crime novel, The Torrent, is being published by HarperCollins. I discovered the Anatomy of a Crime, How to Write a Murder course, and I really thought that would be something that would be useful for me. I just loved it because it really broke down the different aspects of crime. So really right from the motivation to commit a crime through to the afterwards, you know, the arrest and then the prison life as well. And it really went through all the research that you need to do as a crime writer to kind of get those realistic aspects into your writing, so that your readers will go with you on the story. I'm very grateful to the Australian Writers Centre and to the whole community for being able to get me to this stage of having a published novel and continuing to be able to write as my full-time job now.
You can find out more at writerscentre.com.au/murdercourse. That's writerscentre.com.au/murdercourse. And now it's time for our writer in residence this week. Liam Pieper's latest novel is Appreciation. He has also written the novels The Toymaker and Sweetness and Light. In addition to writing novels, he has written his memoir and is a very prolific ghostwriter of many global bestsellers. Thank you so much for joining us today, Liam.
Thank you for having me. What a pleasure.
Congratulations on your latest novel, Appreciation. There are so many things I want to ask you, not only about the novel and about what inspired the novel, but also about the other kind of writing that you do, which absolutely fascinates me. And I know that a lot of our audience are going to be interested as well. But let's first start with Appreciation. Can you tell us what it's about?
Not well. I'm terrible at the elevator pitch. I guess it's a book about, in a nutshell, it's a book about fame. It's about art and fame and wanting those things and how both those things break your brain in different but complementary ways. It's about a generic white celebrity pushing 40. There are some autobiographical notes there. Obviously, my main character is more famous than I am, but a sort of an over-the-hill creative type who's a bit jaded by fame and gets on a recording, gets on a hot mic and says something. This is probably the one thing that can actually get a rich white guy in Australia cancelled. And he becomes a public pariah overnight. So he hires a ghostwriter to write a book about his life and rehabilitate his fame. And calamity ensues. But it's a book about a man reckoning with his life, but also about his relationship with his ghostwriter and the sort of uneasy friendship that they have between them. And in some ways, I love the unreliable narrator as a technique. And so I wanted to write a book about an unreliable person by an unreliable narrator. So it's both the main character, Ollie Darling, who is the hapless white guy, and his ghostwriter, Gemma. They both think they should be the center of the story. They're both sort of fighting to be at the center of the story. So it's sort of a love story between two narcissists in a way. It's about two people who are trying to center themselves in the narrative. One is the main character, one is the narrator. And both of them sort of resent that role, and both of them are trying not to relinquish the spotlight. So the narrator keeps trying to write herself in as the most important character, while the main character kind of takes her for granted because in his eyes, she only exists as a conduit to his story. The whole thing is sort of a playful way for me to look at who gets to tell stories, why they get to tell stories, why am I in this position that I've been given a book deal in the first place? It still seems ridiculous and foolish to me, but here we are. And so look at hierarchies of privilege and centering and storytelling, but in a way that's fun and that, you know, I like books that
very
are
fun,
but also have a meaning behind them.
Yes.
You think so?
Yeah, very fun.
Oh,
and I
so
want to know, did you start off when you first started thinking, I want to write this novel, did you start off thinking initially, oh, I want to tackle issues of fame and, you know, who gets the right to tell stories? Or did you think of the premise? Because the main character is Ollie Darling. He is an artist in the art world in Australia with very Ben Quilty vibes. And which part of it did you start with?
I started with the idea of playing with fame. Okay. The book is in a way it's high farce. It's not at all a realistic book. It's not going for realism. It's heightened. It's farcical. It's a little camp, maybe, I think is what I was going for. Because at the center, it presupposes this idea, this preposterous idea that an artist, that a fine artist would be like a pop cultural figure in Australia. That's kind of a fantasy in itself. Australia is not a lovely country by all means. Don't get me wrong. I don't want to get cancelled on this podcast, but it's not a country that tends to prioritize the arts as its main cultural export, let's say, in the way that the Czech Republic or France does. Chechia is the more current term for that country, which is a shame because we have incredible creative talent here. My artist, strong Quilty vibes. I didn't notice that until now. I hope I haven't offended dear Quilty because...
Oh, come on. Come on. It's interesting that you say it's farcical because, I mean, it's from a particular character's point of view. It's from that character's point of view. So it is also the way he sees things and he sees the world. And I found myself going, is that inspired by Quilty or is that an Abdul Abdallah painting? Is that John McDonald? So tell me why you decided then to set this in the art world and how much of that world were you exposed to or did you have to kind of research it?
I had to research it heavily
as
I was writing because I don't know anything about art. I know what I like. Like, I'm a big fan of art and fine art and contemporary art. I guess the genesis of it comes from when I was younger. I was like the arty boy who would date the arty kids, you know. So I had a few relationships with aspiring artists. And I guess my main romantic rivals at the time painted in like an impasto acrylic style. Like that was what was hip, I guess, because everyone was emulating Quilty. I guess that's where that connection would come from. In terms of the contemporary art world, my experience of it is just going to galleries. I go to whatever's touring. I enjoy it as a consumer, but I'm in no means, but by no means an expert or anything like that. But that's kind of where I wanted to start from. Because I had a place of ignorance that I could write into and just kind of fill the character out. I started this book in lockdown, in the depths of despair. We can get to that in a minute. And like everyone else, I took up hobbies, sourdough. I tried to learn to paint with acrylics because I had a bunch of acrylic paint that I'd been schlepping around ever since I held a job at a paint supply company, with mixed results. So some of that came into it. Why did I start to set in the art world? I mean, the honest answer is it's not set in the art world. It's set in my own solipsism and my own narcissism. I wrote a book about myself. You know, I wrote a book about literature, basically, and ambition and rivalry in that world. And then I got to the end of the book. And I don't know, in Microsoft Word, they have this thing where you can press Control F and you can just replace one word with another. So I found the word book and just replaced it with artwork. And bang, I had a book set in the art world. And after that, the revisions were minimal.
Okay. But the other thing is that it is about his relationship with his ghostwriter. And one of the things that you do, so this is your third novel, right? But you've written a memoir and another sort of memoir and many ghostwritten books because essentially you have kind of like a day job as a ghostwriter.
Yes.
Let's just take a step back and how did you get into ghostwriting?
That's an excellent question and entirely redacted. But I'd written a memoir and then a collection of sort of humorous essays, I guess, reflecting on that. And then, yeah, I guess I'd written one novel when I started to. I started about 10 years ago, ghostwriting, I think. Because my memoir, which was called The Feel Good Hit of the Year, it didn't set the world on fire, but it was sufficiently conflagratory that it burnt my life down, you know, and, you know, ruined, you know, my own relationships and employment prospects. So, you know, it's very difficult to get a job outside of the shadowy world of ghostwriting. You know, when someone Googles you, if you apply for like a job as an English teacher or whatnot. So my employment prospects were mixed, but a publisher that I'd worked with previously contacted me. And there was a true story that was true crime adjacent, let's say. And they were like, we need someone who is comfortable around crims, you know, but someone who is also a bit sensitive, who can listen to a story and mimic voice. And I was, and We think natural mendacity would really lend itself to this role. So I gave it a shot and it worked out. And the book was a success and others followed. I don't know how I keep getting work, but it's publishing. It's a small industry. People move from house to house. People gossip. I tend to, it's a very lucrative, it's a strong word, but it's a comfortable lower middle class remuneration for the work. And it's the first time in my life that I ever could buy groceries. So without it causing me an aneurysm. So it's work that I really enjoy. I know ghostwriters are supposed to be sniffy about it. And like a lot of people do it, but they don't talk about it. But I really, it's a job I genuinely enjoy. And I'm a serviceable writer. I've learned some tricks along the way. I'm not that interesting. I have inside me hope at least 3 novels, hopefully 1 or 2 more. But I only have so many stories to tell and only so much I can possibly contribute to this world. But I have this set of skills, the basic things like what a narrative arc is, what a 3-arc structure is, how to develop characters, how to encapsulate dialogue and capture voice. Skills that you hone over many years of writing, but you only have if you were foolish enough to dedicate your life to writing books. And generally when I'm writing a book with somebody who, for professional distinction, we'll call them the author and me the writer, they're generally people who have done something important. They've done something momentous in sports or statecraft or a true story of heroism or the arts even. And you can only achieve magnificent things if you didn't spend all your time learning what a narrative arc is. So take these skills and I help people tell the story. People know how to tell their own stories, but not necessarily how to fit it inside a C-format paperback.
Yes. Well, you're obviously skilled at this and people recognize that because you've written around 20 ghostwritten books. I know that you sign non-disclosure agreements and can't tell us who you've ghostwritten for, but one that you, I think there's one that you can, Eddie Jaku, right? But tell us what kind of people you are ghostwriting for.
Well, all sorts. That's the thing I love about the job. I mean, it's myriad people. I know I'm not using that word correctly. Myriad means 1,000, but let me get away with it. I don't love people. I'm a misanthrope by nature, but I'm fascinated by people. I love meeting people. I love to hear their stories. And the work takes me in contact with all sorts of people. I don't specialize in one particular niche of person because I go where the work takes me and if I get along with the person. So sporting stars or survivors of great tragedy or politicians or scientists or comics, anyone who has something interesting to say, I help them find a way to frame it because people know how to tell their own stories. I just help them get there. So it's a difficult question to answer. Like, who do I write for? The answer is everybody.
You said, though, if I get along with them. So is there some kind of initial sussing out session? Do you have a process of deciding whether to take on the project?
Yes, absolutely. Because you're only going to be able to work with somebody. It's an intensive and extensive process. And you're only going to be able to capture someone's voice if you get along with them. It's a little like a blind date or somewhere between a blind date and a therapy session. You sit down and you just see if you connect, if there's a spark, if you are going to be able to get along. And sometimes that's just not there. Sometimes you're not the right fit for each other. You sit down and you talk to someone and you look for the story that they're trying to tell. And you can tell instinctively whether you're going to be able to help tell that story. And if not, no hard feelings, you part ways. But otherwise you go on it. And it's never smooth sailing. There's always bumps in the road. And writing a book, particularly if it's a debut book for people, is an incredibly stressful and revealing task. So yeah, you want to be friends at the very least.
So if by the time you've ghostwritten 20 books, you must also have some kind of process or system in that, can you describe to us do you decide, okay, it's going to take X number of months, we're going to meet X number of times, and then within that, what's your process of extracting the information?
Good questions. Also unanswerable. It's it really depends on the person, because sometimes they're extremely famous and only have incredibly limited time because they have to be in a million places at the same time, or they might be traveling widely. So you might get an hour a week in which, you know, and it ekes out over a year, or someone might only be available for this week or these 2 weeks of the month. And so you're going to spend a lot of time intensely with them. Sometimes it's over Zoom. Sometimes it's meeting. Those are my favorites, particularly if the client can cook. So a little tip, if you're ever having your book ghostwritten, if you bring out a little tray of deli sandwiches at the beginning of every meeting, you're going to get a much better book out of your ghostwriter. It's a lovely thing to do. So it's different every time, and it depends on the client and it depends on their particular needs, because some people come with a full manuscript and they just need a little help moving it around. In that case, the job is just that of an editor. It's just another level of editorial before it goes to an editor. Sometimes you're working from scratch. Sometimes a person, English might not be their first language. They just might not be very eloquent in the written word, but are in the... they speak, they could be great oral storytellers. In that case, it's just a matter of transcribing it and helping them put those puzzle pieces in place around the frame. The job is different every time, but that's what I love about it. In the case of Eddie Jaku, I suppose I can talk about him because he was a mensch and he was quite insistent that I be acknowledged as the writer of the book. For Eddie, may his memory be a blessing, sadly he's no longer with us. The story was there. He knew exactly what he wanted to say. So in that job, it was just, my task was just to help him clarify that and narrow it down. And that meant not muddying his message and not trying to dress it up too much. He was such a wise, kind, dignified, special person. And if I tried to get too fancy and literary, I'll be leading him astray and I would be doing his story a disservice. So it was a matter of just kind of finding the nuggets of his wisdom and helping him convey that in simple English. Because English, he spoke English perfectly well, but it was his fifth language. He just needed a little help with that, clarifying that message and purifying it to the, you know, specific core messages like don't hate people, listen, hug your mother. These are the things that were important to him. And so to get those on the page as quickly and eloquently as possible, that's what that book needed. That's what Eddie needed. And hopefully we were successful in conveying that. I like to hope so. He was 100 when we did that book.
Oh, my God.
But it published into the pandemic. But there was a year after the pandemic when he got to tour and got to go to bookshops and meet readers and do festivals. And boy, you've never seen a happier author in your life. Writers, we can be a disgruntled demographic. We can be ungrateful for what we have sometimes. And so it was beautiful to see just this wonderful man at the very late stages of his life achieve this dream that he had. And there's very little more rewarding than that you could ever hope for, I think, when you write books.
So it's probably no surprise that there is the other character, the ghostwriter, in this novel. Now, let's talk about this novel then in terms of its creation. Can you give us a just kind of like a timeline? You said you started it in the depths of COVID. How long then did it take before you had a manuscript you were happy with? And in that period, were you writing full time, or like how much time were you dedicating to it?
Like 27 hours a day, I'd say. It was, so I guess to bridge from the last question about ghostwriting, I was just cavilling about how much I love the job. The ghostwriter in my book doesn't love the job. The character of Gemma, of the ghostwriter, she's quite frustrated and kind of hates her client, which has not been my experience of ghostwriting, but I could easily imagine how you could go that way, because at the beginning of it was the first draft was written in those first couple of months of lockdown, and all those feelings of uncertainty and dread and self-loathing that I had, which I'll perhaps elaborate on, So I found myself in those first months of lockdown in a very strange time personally, because my last book, which was Sweetness and Light, which is kind of a moral thriller set in the world of travel, of international tourism, was a book I wrote quite specifically for people to read on airplanes, to buy in airports and to read in airplanes. I wanted something that would be thrilling to read on a plane. It came out in March 2020.
Oh, my
when
God.
There were...
when all planes were grounded in the world.
And so it kind of sank without a trace. A novel at the best of times has a shelf life roughly that of yogurt. It's good for 3 weeks on the shelf, and then there's a week where you're a bit iffy about it, and then it's in the bin. That's just kind of the life cycle of books in bookstores. So I never really got time in bookstores or got to shine in that way, which was a humbling experience made worse by my own hubris, because the book before that, The Toymaker, which is a historical novel, had been like a moderate success. So like there was some marketing spend on this next book, and I'd been a real brat about it. I was like, I had a list of demands from my publisher. I was like, I want posters in the streets, light walls in the airports, no brown M&Ms in my bowl. I was a real diva about the whole thing. And then I was living in Sydney at the time, and I went to fly back to Melbourne to start doing press. You get on the radio, you do all that kind of thing. But when I landed, they declared lockdown, and my publicist was like, got on the phone, like, you need to get back on the plane. Like, we can't, it's all over. Everything's cancelled. And so I had to sort of turn around and walk back through the airport. But because I'd been such a brat about publicity, what airport light walls are, they're those like electronic posters that move.
Yep, that are often just scattered throughout the airport, but also in front of the airport bookshops a lot.
Yes, exactly. So there was my face on all of those, just kind of like sliding down the wall as I was walking through this empty airport, not sure if I had a life-threatening illness or not. It was a very, very surreal and humbling experience. So I was starting from there, and I got back to my Sydney apartment, which you could charitably describe as a hovel. Many, many roaches, wonderful roach population in my apartment, and like stuck in a tiny apartment for months. And in one way, I'd never been less professionally successful. I'd never been deeper in debt. I'd never felt less successful or famous. But at the same time, due to the confluence of both the success of Eddie's book and kind of the joy that I got in watching him experience that readership, and because I was very busy with my day job, because the pandemic started and suddenly everyone who worked in entertainment couldn't get on the TV, so they all became authors. So I was very, very busy just doing book after book after book after book, and spending all day talking to really quite famous, good-looking, successful people. And it is a very quite intense and intimate process. And celebrities are just regular people, only more so. They have the same insecurities and same doubts and the same desires and the same petty jealousies and joys and wants as at anyone else, but just everyone's watching them. So the volume is turned up to 10. And it's tough to lead life like that. And while I was lamenting the fact that I was no longer famous, or that like I was teetering on the brink of some literary, I guess, accolade that I'd imagined for myself, I saw that vanish. And at the same time, I had this window into this world of fame. So those two things coalesced with this feeling of what nowness that was at the start of lockdown. And that became the first draft of this book, which was finished very quickly in the first few months. I mean, that draft was garbage, but I tinkered with it very, very slowly over the next 3 years until I finally got it to a state where I hope it's acceptable.
More than acceptable. And I think now, and I must admit, I did not read your previous novel, but I'm going back and I'm definitely going to be picking it up.
It's very depressing.
It's very depressing, did you say?
It's a different kind of book. It's less fun. It's grim. It's the ending. I don't think it's giving anything away to say that it's all predicated on the ending. The whole book is for the ending, which is so depressing that I One elderly reader read it and was so distressed that she wrote to me and asked me to rewrite it.
Oh my God.
Which I did because I was locked down. I had nothing else on. So I wrote her a alternate ending with a.
Are
with
you
a
serious? You wrote for one specific person an alternate ending to the previous novel, Sweetness and Light.
Yes, it was a matter of 3 pages. but I can completely understand. It was a perfectly reasonable request.
What was their response?
Thank you. You're much nicer. I'm glad they lived happily ever after.
Oh my Lord. Bespoke author services. Okay, so let's come back to appreciation. You then tinkered with it and decided, okay, it's ready. When the tinkering, was it tinkering? And essentially in that first draft, that the first where you got most of it out, did you know when you started that process what was going to happen? Or did you just, I'm just going to keep writing and see where the story goes?
Bit of both. I do apologize for my incredibly vague, prevaricating answers, but that's just me. I knew what was going to happen broadly. I knew okay. that my the way...
You thought it through at the start, though, is the point. Oh, yeah, you did. So tell me about that. How long did you let it brew while you were thinking about the story?
The broad arc of the story came to me quite quickly. I know that it starts here with him losing his fame. And I know it ends in this one place with the narrative frame of the book switching and the revelations that happen in the final chapter. I'm trying to think of a way I can talk around this without spoiling the book for those who haven't read it.
Yeah, no, don't do that.
Because while the ending, it's not a traditional twist. It's a sort of, it's a twist on a twist, let's say. And so I knew that those two places in between. And in between, I knew sort of the beats that I was going to hit, because I wanted the book to be a picaresque, like a sort of a rollicking journey through, if not the world, the art world, then through fame. But then as I explored the art world and the idea of culture and of art and of fine art being transmuted from something that's created for beauty and for pleasure and for consumption by people into just another asset to be laundered by high finance. You know, that this was an idea that was very central to me. That was something I wanted to play with. That element of the book, which again, I don't want to spoil too much, but is based on a experience I had many lifetimes ago when I was a gangster.
But you say that very casually, okay.
it's been a big week.
Okay.
I was exposed to the ways in which, villains of various sorts launder their money. And there's a million ways to do it. But this idea of buying art as an asset in which to store your ill-gotten gains is not new. And it's something that I heard rumor was happening in the underworld back when I was true crime adjacent. And I was like, I have no idea if that is true or not, but gosh, it's a good story. So that was, I knew that was the middle point of the story. And I knew that we hit these two beats in between and then in the middle. And in between, there's 6 chapters, I hope, in the book. Otherwise, I'll be disgracing myself now. But there's six main scenes, sort of six main stops in a journey. And so there's a three-arc act, rise, cruise, fall, like the Icarus story, which is telegraphed in the first page. So I had that. And then within each of those arcs, there were 2 chapters, which I had to break it out. And each of those chapters would be a big scene. And each of that scene would be a different aspect of someone trying to rehabilitate their fame and get back their sense of identity. And so I had those 6 big scenes planned out. And I also knew that as the book progressed, the narrator would write herself more and more into the narrative and become more and more of a character. So what starts as a functionary sort of flat character, while we're more in the perspective of our main character, Ollie Darling, by the end of the book has turned the tables and reclaimed her power, I guess, over the story. And that's where we land there. So I had all of this plotted out onto just a page. And then there was a matter of making a lot of wrong turns along the way to get there. It's different for everyone, this type of how you plan a book. But for me, I like to have a plan and then ruin it,
Okay, and so listeners, you're going to have to buy the book and read it, and trust me, it'll be worth it for you to understand how Liam has done all of this and how he is a master of the three-act structure as well. Now, I want to end with this question because I'm very curious. You say, and I'm sure you exaggerate a bit, about the hubris you had with the last novel and, you know, sort of some of your expectations and what was going to happen on the literary scene for that. What has your attitude been this time around?
Everything is a bonus. I don't think I ever lost sight of my love of writing, which stems from my love of reading. But it's very easy when you're a young man. Like, young men are awful. Like, the hubris is built in. When you're a young man, to like to lose sight of why you do these things. And I suppose I began, a taste of literary success and getting international deals and seeing my work in foreign bookstores and that kind of thing. Amazing, amazing. But then, like all amazing experiences, I suffer. I've, as those who have read my, well, any of my books know, I have substance abuse issues in my past. So I'm very wired for dopamine, any sort of pleasurable experience. I'm going to want more of that. So I was very excited about the potential for the next book. The humbling thing, I mean, this will sound like a lie, but it's very valuable. It helped me recontextualize why do we do this? No one's making us do this. No one makes us write. We do it because how wonderful, like what a privilege, what a gift to be able to do that. And while I can't write my fiction all day as I might like to, I'm lucky enough to tell stories all day with that. Part of it too is that, and this might actually answer your question you asked earlier about who do I write books for. I'm often writing books for people at the end of their life, when they have retired or are just of an advanced age and are ready to pass on their wisdom and what they know and get what wisdom they've gathered through their years onto the record. So I spent a lot of my 30s hanging out with 80-year-olds and kind of just becoming very close friends with these people who would no longer be with us soon. To be at the coalface of their wisdom and what they know and their perspective on life after they've lived so many decades, for one thing, but also had these extraordinary experiences and seen history firsthand and lived through history and been part of it and helped shape it. And just the fact of human dignity at the end of life, that's what a privilege, what an incredible thing to experience. You can't pay for that kind of perspective. I mean, you can charge a small fee for it and then put a book out into the market, which is what I do all day. I've rounded 40 recently. And hopefully, I think I'm at peace with the idea of like pursuing glory for the sake of it. I know that that's a fairly hollow goal. We write because we want to leave a record of our thoughts and what we imagine the world might want to know, or at least, at the very least, to make them laugh a little, which was my goal here.
And on that note, thank you so much for your time today, Liam. Everyone, get a copy of Appreciation by Liam Pieper. You won't regret it. It's absolutely fantastic and such a great read. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. This is amazing. Thank you. I had a wonderful time.
I hope you enjoyed my chat with Liam. Now, I want to leave you with this fun fact. Did you know that the word gargoyle, as in, you know, the scary creatures carved into the side of churches and in, you know, lots of places where I went to uni at the University of Sydney, and part of their function is to drain away rainwater. So the word gargoyle actually comes from the old French word gargoule, which is exactly as it sounds, like the word gargle. The creatures actually collect rainwater and then it gargles out of their throats and mouths. There you go. You might never look at a gargoyle the same way again. Thanks for listening, and I look forward to chatting to you again next time. Thanks for listening to So You Want to Be a Writer. You'll find the show notes at writercentre.com.au/podcast.
or sign up for our awesome and often hilarious weekly newsletter at writercentre.com.au/news, where you'll find writing resources, giveaways, competitions, and much more.